So I want to continue with this second domain of the Brahmaviharas, which is compassion. Now, please bear in mind that as we speak about and reflect upon compassion, metta has not somehow been left behind. In many of the early texts, compassion is often spoke about almost as an outgoing metta, as an extended metta. And again, it is one of those borrowed words, for lack of a word in English that completely translates anukampa karuna, which is a bit more of a mouthful than compassion. But bearing in mind that it's a borrowed word, so I want to talk about how compassion is actually seen within the context, not only of the Brahmaviharas, but of course the whole of the Buddhist teaching, and of course not only within the Buddhist tradition, how many great spiritual traditions rest themselves upon the cultivation of compassion. So again, compassion is spoken about as a quality, a way of being in this world that is immeasurable, fearless, without conditions, and unshakable. And it's said to be the deepest motivation and aspiration of this path. In many of the texts, you read the lines, out of compassion we cultivate this practice, this path. Out of compassion, we turn towards all living beings. Out of compassion, we cultivate ethics. Out of compassion, we cultivate an unobstructed heart and clear eyes. So it is so central as a motivation. And, many of you will be quite familiar with the Bodhisattva vow, which some way encapsulates this from the Mahayana traditions, which tend to be far more poetic, I might say, than the early texts. And it's expressed, sentient beings are numberless. I vow to rescue them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Afflictions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. So there's a sense of, at times, knowing the impossibility of bringing all suffering to an end in this world, but living and acting in a way as if it is possible. Okay, so that is the kind of intention that is the underlying attitude of living and acting in a way as if it is possible. This is how the Buddha describes this quality of nobility of the heart. It would be extremely difficult to find anywhere in the early texts the encouragement to cultivate this path as a way of improving ourselves, or simply having wonderful meditative experiences, or to become concentrated as an end in itself, or as a way of improving our defense mechanisms. I mean, compassion is really said to be the quality that moves us from the language of I and you to the language of us. To the language of us. And it's deeply rooted in insight. Compassion, I don't believe, can be developed outside of understanding. It's deeply rooted in the understanding of ignorance. But if I mention the primary insight aspect of this domain of the Brahmaviharas, and I will go into this in much more detail in a bit, it is primarily concerned with understanding our relationship to pain. Because it is our relationship to pain that comes to define who we believe ourselves to be, and how we engage with the world. So this is the insight element of compassion that I'd like you just to sort of store in the background of your attention, and we'll return to it in more detail in a bit. So there are two words in Pali that really describe what we use one word compassion for. Now, one word we're very familiar with, or some of you will be very familiar with, the word karuna. And the other aspect of compassion is held within this Pali word, anukampa. Now, they're slightly different, but they go together. Now, it is actually this word, anukampa, that describes the quality of empathy. A-N-U-K-H-A-M-P-A. Anukampa. So this is a word that primarily describes the quality of empathy, the capacity of our hearts to tremble in the face of suffering. This is anukampa, the empathic element of responsiveness, of this way of being present in the world, our capacity to see ourselves in the eyes of another, to have the stillness and the sensitivity to be deeply touched by the sorrow and pain of another. It is almost a preverbal responsiveness. Almost a preverbal responsiveness. It's not concerned with fixing or with finding solutions, but of being wholeheartedly present within the sorrows of life. So I think you can sense the relationship between anukampa and metta. Because for that empathy really to develop, we need to be close. We need to be intimate. We do not develop empathy from a distance or from a place of disconnection. So metta, in a way, is almost setting the ground for this anukampa, this capacity for the heart to tremble or for the heart to quiver in the face of suffering, by the way, not only externally, but internally. Okay, that's very important. Not only externally, but internally. Now, the second aspect of what we call compassion is actually this word karuna, which literally translates as turning outwardly. So it is an aspect of compassion, which of course is widening the circle of our concern, but it is also the dimension of compassion which is almost concerned with a more active nuance, how we engage with suffering, how our actions, our thoughts, our words follow the pathways dedicated to uprooting the causes of suffering, to healing where healing is possible, to liberating where liberating is possible. So this word karuna has much more this dynamic nuance that is, in a way, it is a receptive and the engaged. The receptive and the actual reaching out towards. So this is clearly also has much to do with wise action, with wise speech, you know, with wise thought, with wise relationship. So it is actually not, you know, there is nothing passive within this. But this aspect of anukampa is primary because, as I mentioned this morning, too often we are almost moving into the doing element prior to the empathy element. And when we do that, it's often almost the near enemy of karuna, which is, I think, about fixing things or making things go away or, you know, finding solutions. So anukampa is a necessary forerunner of karuna, and I just really want to stress that. But karuna is what translates empathy or anukampa into thoughts, words, and actions. And I think you see this in some of the traditional kind of figures that are used to represent compassion, particularly the figure of Kuan Yin, you know, which is kind of almost a traditional representation of compassion, when unlike the Buddha statues, who you often see with eyes closed and, you know, sitting composed on a lotus leaf, Kuan Yin has eyes open, is actually pouring out the elixirs that heal the sorrows of the world, is, you know, holding the book of the teachings that are going to be offered. And Kuan Yin is sometimes portrayed actually as an armed warrior, you know, fully blessed with crossbows and shields, dedicated to uprooting the causes of suffering. Now, this word karuna, I mean, this is a very small sidebar, has its roots, and it's a much earlier word from the Vedas, which is kriya. And kriya was usually concerned with ritualistic offerings, you know, what people did, you know, ritualistic offerings to the gods to actually ensure certain results. So the Buddha took it, it actually translates as holy action. So the Buddha took this word karuna, kind of kriya, slightly transposed it, as he did with many of the words of that time, and turned it into the field of human relationship. How we act, how we engage, how we speak. So karuna has this embodied element, and I'm very aware that to speak about embodiment is a very understandably uncomfortable exploration for many of us, because it's easier to think about compassion than to embody it. You know, it's easier to think about metta than to embody it. So karuna is something, again, compassion is something much more than a feeling or an emotion. It really describes our dedication to healing suffering and almost asks us to redefine our understanding of healing. To uprooting the causes of suffering. Now, as I mentioned, compassion can't be separated from metta or from mindfulness. Mindfulness is turning towards all things, metta, standing near to, and compassion is the responsiveness to the difficult in a fearless and wise way. So there is a continuum here, and I think it's really good to notice that continuum. Now, again, this is an area where the Buddha is very much building upon something we already know or have already experienced in our lives. I don't think compassion, I'm going to use the word compassion instead of anukampa karuna because it will take me twice as long, actually. But I'd like you to bear that anukampa karuna in your mind because this is what gives it its multidimensional sense. It's not a stranger to us. In times of distress in our own lives, probably many of us have experienced what it is like to be responded to with empathy, with kindness, with the wholehearted presence of a person who projects no blame and is not busy trying to fix what is going on. And we know compassion in ourselves, the unhesitating responsiveness to the pain in another. Milarepa, one of the great sages of the past, he even said that just as I would reach out to touch and heal a wound in my leg as part of this body, why would I not reach out to touch and heal the wound in another as part of this body? So this is primarily concerned, obviously, with the presence of suffering. Now, these moments of compassion often come unsought. We know intuitively, I think, the profound value and meaning of compassion. But we also know many other times, you know, when compassion feels very elusive, where we feel very distant, where we can feel very disconnected, or where we're just so preoccupied, actually, with our own life concerns that there hardly feels room for another. Where there hardly feels room for another. This is not something to judge or feel ashamed of, but to know that the very kind of impulse of compassion is to continue to widen our circle of concern and have our home within an immeasurable compassion. Now, there are different dimensions of compassion, and I really am not going to spend a whole lot of time with these, or probably more than I think, but they also, they're not only external dimensions, they're internal ones, okay? And this is, of course, when we go to the Visuddhimagga, actually, where these Brahmaviharas are most frequently unpacked and spoken about in the commentarial traditions, it's very, very different than with metta, where often, you know, it starts with the easiest, gradually works towards the difficult. The commentaries actually approach this slightly differently. That yes, there is the first approach, if we cultivate this as a formal practice, to reflect upon the suffering in this world that feels quite blameless and quite innocent. You know, a child or actually anyone who's suddenly struck with an unexpected illness or loss or pain, you know, the heartache that comes with losing someone you love. You know, it's quite, you know, the sorrow of someone being, you know, caught in a set of circumstances which are not of their making. You know, our whole populations of refugees and, you know, people who just simply are not there of their own making. And I think it's almost a kind of it's almost a domain of compassion which is responding to this kind of innocence, almost, of pain. You know, you're not tracing a causal relationship where blame arises. You know, it's a sort of innocence to pain. This is the first aspect. But then actually, in the commentarial traditions, it immediately jumps to actually not somewhere that's easier or easy, but to those who perpetuate harm, to those who inflict pain, who seem to be intentionally harming or wounding or injuring another or the world we live in. And of course, this would also include, you know, the people in our own lives who we feel that we suffer at the hands of. You know, the people who blame us or shame us or dislike us, you know, that collection of people that probably we all have one or two in our lives. And we recognize how compassion can seem to disappear in the face of the undeserving. There's a Greek saying, and the only people who are deserving of compassion are those who are undeserving of their suffering. This is not the approach of the Brahma Viharas. Probably a lot of people in this room, a lot of us in this room might disappear at this moment if that were true. You know? Compassion rests upon kindness, but it equally rests upon courage and fearlessness. But it rests most deeply upon understanding dukkha, unsatisfactoriness in all of its elements, and our reactions to dukkha. This is the core of the Buddha's teaching. He said, I teach just one thing, that there is dukkha and that there is the end of dukkha. Mind you, he had a lot more to say. Because he also said, dukkha is to be understood. The more I think about this, and this is how I started this presentation this afternoon, the more I reflect on this, the more do I see that how we, our relationship to pain and how we respond to pain really does come to define who we believe ourselves to be, what is possible for us as human beings, and how we live our lives. If we, the Buddha saw that not only is dukkha universal, but so too are many of our reactions to dukkha. Now, I need to break this down a little bit at this point, and it's a slight sidebar, but please, to understand the word dukkha is really important. Okay? So there's three domains to dukkha. The first domain is what is called dukkha-dukkha. This is the pain of pain. Double dukkha. This is very kind of primal level of dukkha. Aging, sickness, death, body breakdowns, you know, pain, injury. It's dukkha-dukkha. It's the pain of pain. It also includes, of course, the whole domain of loss and grief. But this is the dukkha-dukkha that is part of everybody's experience in this room. It is part of our life. It is an interwoven thread. This is part of being a human being, is dukkha-dukkha. I call it one of the unarguables. You know, no one in this room has an exemption. We're all going to face our own measure of sickness, of frailty, of aging, and of course dying. We will all have our own measure of losses that we are asked to meet and grief. So this is one of the unarguables. It's dukkha-dukkha. It's not anybody's fault. It's not because we've done something wrong. It is because we are human. And the second domain of dukkha is called viparinami dukkha. Now, this is also an unarguable. So viparinami dukkha is describing the world of change and the instability of conditions. That impermanence is one of those eternal laws that runs through all experience, and there is nothing that we see, hear, touch, feel, care about or hate that is exempt from impermanence. Okay, it runs through everything formed, it runs through every mental state, it runs through every psychological aspect of our being. There is change. Okay, we all know this, you know. I mean, we didn't need the Buddha to tell us this, but this is an area where we have remarkable amnesia, you know. And we have a lot of argument, actually, with this unarguable. But the other aspect of viparinami dukkha is the instability of conditions, that we couldn't get up this morning and decide to have a hot, sunny day. You know, I think of almost the weather patterns of life. You know, the way that conditions come together in a certain matrix, and we have one thing. And if they came together in a certainly different matrix, we would have something else. You know, it's almost like you put certain things together, you have a cupcake, you put other things together, you have a bagel. You know, it's kind of, that's very crude, you know. But this is, we're not in charge. We're not in charge of the world of conditions. We're not in charge of the world of change. This is viparinami dukkha. This is also an unarguable. Now, both of these domains of the unarguables are very asking of compassion. Very asking of compassion. But in the absence of compassion, what we get into is the third domain of dukkha, which is called sankhata dukkha. This is where we layer pain upon pain. Okay? Sankhata dukkha. You may be more familiar with the word sankhara if you have some background reading. This is sankhara or sankhata dukkha. This is where we layer emotional and psychological habit patterns upon the unarguables and have an argument with them. You know? I want this, I don't want this, I like this, this shouldn't be happening, this needs to be different than it is, I'm afraid of this, I hate this, you know, this is bad, this is all the rest of it. This is Sankhata Dukkha. Many of you will be familiar with the teaching story of the person who struck by the two arrows. Okay, some of you know this, some of you don't know this. Okay, but it's a really important teaching story to know, because it describes the whole transformational element of the teaching. So I will repeat it. So those of you who know it, please don't roll your eyes. So there is a person who is struck by an arrow. It hurts. Huh? It hurts. And then the Buddha says, an untaught worldling, having been struck by an arrow, will weep and wail and beat their breast. And so they experience two kinds of pain, the pain of the arrow and the emotional pain of the reaction. He says a well-taught worldling will get struck by an arrow and it will hurt, but they do not weep and wail and beat their breast and berate the world. So therefore they only experience one kind of pain, the pain of the arrow, rather than the two kinds of pain, of the pain of the arrow and the pain of the reaction to the arrow. This is one of the most pivotal teaching stories of the Buddha. Now, Sankhata Dukkha, it also merits compassion. But it merits compassion. But it is actually understanding that if we don't bring compassion to this third layer of dukkha, if we do not bring compassion to the first two domains of dukkha, we will bring sankhata dukkha. We will bring the extra layer of pain, and it will come to define who we are as a human being and how we live our life. If you think about it, if I fear pain, it's an expression of a belief in incapacity. A belief in our incapacity to meet life as it is. And if I only fear pain, it's very likely that my life is going to be governed by avoidance patterns, isn't it? How do I stay away from even the mildly unpleasant, never mind the big pains of aging, sickness and death? I'm going to get involved in a lot of avoidance patterns. This is Sankhata Dukkha. If I have an aversion to pain, which is another way of fearing pain, of course. If I have an aversion to pain, it's very likely that my mind is going to be very heavily preoccupied with anger and blame. It's like, who shot that arrow? You know, and I'm not dealing with it until I figure out who shot it and what it's made of and why they shot it. You know, it likely will deal with a lot of aversion and blame. And sometimes that's directed inwardly. If we have notions of clinging to a perfect self, it's very likely that we might feel a lot of guilt about the first two domains of dukkha. We get sick and we think, I've done something wrong. Or it's somehow my fault. Now, all of these reactions, these layers or these threads of Sankhata Dukkha, are what the Buddha described as being the unwise reactions to pain and to suffering that actually create and recreate dukkha, dukkha moment to moment in our life. They lead to more dukkha. Oh, sorry, there's another reaction to the first two domains of dukkha I didn't mention, which is basically to get busy. Get busy, turn Google on, you know, I'm going to find the solution to this, you know, I'm going to, you know, bring up my web doctor, somebody's got an answer to how to make this go away. So the Buddha described all of these as the unwise reactions to dukkha. And he said, what is the wise reaction to dukkha? The first two domains, and actually the third domain, because it's just as much suffering, to investigate it, to understand it, to stand close to it, to bring compassion where there is no compassion. This is what calms our arguments with the unarguables. This is what allows us to approach the pain that is in our life rather than being governed and defined by it. These are not easy lessons for us to learn, I would suggest. It takes, I think, an enormous amount of humility. I mean, sometimes we are very good at extending compassion to others, not always so skilled at standing in the midst of our own struggles and adversity and afflictions with that same heart that can tremble and actually respond. But it is a humbling insight, I think, and this is the insight part of this practice. And it's humbling to know that we're not exempt from these first two domains of dukkha, that age and sickness and death are personal experiences, and they are the experiences that place us firmly in the family of all beings. That we cannot control conditions or make anything stand still for us. They are the unarguables that we learn to put our argument down with. We see how our reactions to dukkha create the solidity of a sense of self. You know, I hate this, I'm unworthy, I'm afraid of this, I'm weak, I'm frail, I'm a failure, whatever. We create the other, and I spoke about this morning. Often it is our very reactions to dukkha that create a sense of self and simultaneously reify the sense of other. Now, sometimes the other is external, you know, the person we despise or the person that we fear. But sometimes the other is internal. So the body experience we find hard to embrace becomes the enemy. The thoughts that we don't welcome or feel are unacceptable, they become the other and the enemy. The emotions that don't fit into our idea of, you know, a good yogi or a good person, they become the other. And the self and the other are simultaneously created and simultaneously strengthened. The bigger the sense of I and the bigger the sense of other is, the bigger the narrative that we feel stuck in. The softening of the sense of self, the softening of the sense of the other is the calming of that narrative that we no longer feel so stuck in. And this is where our hearts can quiver. In giving up the argument, I mean, I think there's this statement, you know, it is as it is. This is not a statement of passivity. It's about meeting the threads of dukkha in our life as they are. It is as it is. Then we have the capacity to ask the next question of, what does this need? Rather than, how do I make this go away? And in a sense, this is almost the kind of the heart of compassion, of karuna, that follows that trembling of, what does this need? Good moment for a pause, I think.
Is there a practice with compassion as we did with metta in our meditation? Do we bring the same people to mind or other situations as they arise?
I mean, again, the question is around, actually, you know, a formal cultivation of metta. Is it of compassion? Is it the same as with metta, following through the similar realms? No, it's not. I would not suggest so. I mean, certainly, in the commentaries, you know, one follows a certain pattern of development, you know, because here the whole question is for us, you know, is compassion something that is accidental, or again, is this an inclination of the mind that can actually be cultivated? From the perspective of Buddhist psychology, this is an inclination of the mind that can be cultivated. You know, the unhesitating moments of compassion we all experience in our life are a taste of a seed of possibility that asks to be built upon. Now, in the early texts, you will notice the Buddha has very little advice about how to practice. Very, very little. I mean, he just really doesn't talk hardly at all about actual techniques. He talks about frameworks of contemplation. So, for example, the Satipatthana Sutta, the teaching of mindfulness, gives a framework for establishing mindfulness. The teaching of the Discourse on Metta gives a framework for cultivating metta. There is no discourse on compassion, yet it's in almost every discourse. But there, because it's almost a given that this is why you practice, as a response to dukkha, that the other responses to dukkha are both meaningless and futile, that this is why we practice. But the Buddha was not into prescriptive practices. You know, for the last 2,500 years, people have been trying to figure out how to actually cultivate this stuff. But the Buddha was very, very clear that this is a cultivation. This is a training. This is learning to incline the mind towards, which involves discipline, it involves rigor, it involves dedication, it involves perseverance. You know, it involves all of these qualities that are described as awakening qualities. Now, if you move to the commentarial traditions, then you see a lot more prescriptions, okay, a lot more technique recommendation. So in the commentarial traditions, one starts with the domain that I first spoke about, which is the domain where we don't have so many filters around compassion, the domain of the innocent, the helpless, the blameless. And of course, we encounter this every day in our life, don't we? You know, the bird gets eaten by the cat. You know, the cat gets run over by the car. You know, we encounter, you know, I'm sorry to be so graphic, but it's not like we're talking about some abstract concept here. You know, we hear the cry of a baby, you know. We see an elderly person, you know, struggling to cross the street. You know, every day of our lives, if the eyes are open, the ears are open, we are encountering this first domain of dukkha, you know, the aging, the sickness, the death, the frailty, the uncertainty of conditions. We don't have to go very far. You know, we see it in ourselves. You know, you wake up in the morning, you know, you have a crick in your neck. You don't go necessarily who put that pillow there. It just hurts, you know. It just hurts, you know. Or meeting an illness, you know, that you're never invited to. You know, they're just feeling a little frailer, some of us ourselves, you know. We meet this every day of our life, but how do we attend to this? So it's not like we need a big practice. We can have a framework of contemplation that we begin with. And here we learn to pause, and we learn to stop, and we learn to develop that capacity for anukampa, for the heart to tremble in the face of suffering. We don't ignore it. We don't get into the argument with the unarguables, whether it's inwardly or outwardly. We learn, this is dukkha. This is dukkha. What does this need? It needs this responsiveness. Then, you know, if you go to the commentarial tradition, then you might use some phrases if it's helpful. You know, if it's helpful to remind you to stay there and to stay close to. And again, this would very much be the phrasing of in the midst of, because there is a lot of suffering that doesn't go away. There's a lot of suffering where there is no solution, you know, that cannot be fixed. You know, we cannot fix aging, despite the advertising industry. We cannot. You know? So, you know, may you find ease of heart in the midst of this. Relational qualities. So it's not about making this go away. It's relational intentions. You know, may you find ease of heart in the midst of this. May you find healing in the midst of this. Doesn't mean that something comes to an end. The healing may be the putting down of our argument with the unarguable. So the phrases can be helpful as ways of anchoring that relatedness, of staying present. But of course, then if you go to the commentarial traditions, it's immediately shifting over to the hard territory, the places where compassion feels most difficult. For those where there seems to be a causal relationship, you know, where someone seems to be acting, is acting with harshness, or, you know, is acting in ways that are wounding or harmful to another, who's, you know, blasting aversion out in the world or ill will out in the world. I mean, again, we just need to turn on our televisions. We do not need to look far for this. We often just need to walk down a street. And there, that's where we experience, isn't it, how our relationship to pain turns to define our life. You know, how we turn away or how we immediately jump into the blame. You know, my first teacher, you know, in the Mahayana tradition, I mean, his first teaching to me was always swallow the blame. And at first, you know, my Western response to this was no way. You know, I swallow the blame, they're going to get away with it. You know, they're going to get away with it. But that's not what he was saying. He was saying that, speaking about the impossibility of changing this mutually engaged ill will by actually understanding the ignorance that is beneath unskillfulness and harmfulness. Can I see harmfulness without moving into aversion, without moving into blame? Can I see the suffering of ignorance? This is a huge ask. It's a huge ask. And yet, of course, we have people, the people we most admire in this life are the people who've done just that. You know, whether it's Gandhi or whether it's the Dalai Lama or, you know, the people, or whether it's Martin Luther King Jr., the people we admire the most in this life are the people who have done just that. And they haven't become condoning. They haven't become excusing. They haven't become dysfunctional. In fact, probably the most effective people in this world that we admire in terms of bringing about social and political transformation are the people who have known how to swallow the blame and to find that uprightness in faced with those who perpetuate harm. Now, of course, it's very easy to think somehow they were preordained to do this. Learned this in the hard classroom of their lives, didn't they? Learned this in the hard classroom of our lives. And I think sometimes there's a part of us that just doesn't quite trust that. You know? Somehow feels that we're not able or we're not capable or somehow we're not endowed with those same seeds or those same possibilities. But of course, from the perspective of the Buddhist teaching, we all are. We all are. So from the commentarial traditions, we would go from where there's an unhesitating compassion responsiveness to the domain where it's really hesitating. Really hesitating. Then in the commentarial traditions, it would move through more the familiar domains of metta, of friends, benefactors, self. I mean, personally, I just would never, ever underestimate the challenge of this. But then I think this is the challenge of a human life. Is actually about, you know, and this is, I think, certainly the challenge of the Buddha's teaching, is actually to how to find that nobility and courage and dignity in the midst of the most difficult circumstances of our lives. How how our relationship to pain governs who we come to believe ourselves to be and how we live our lives. Shantideva once put it, he says, when you see someone beating another with a stick, don't be angry with the stick, but with the hatred that wields it. And I think this is where the whole aspect of karuna really weaves in, because karuna is about how we respond to the causes of pain. You know, I mean, karuna requires us to be an active participant in the kind of world that we live in. Karuna asks us to widen the circle of our concern and to actually meet the pain and the causes of pain in those around us with a dedication to bring it to an end. But the two need to go hand in hand. The Buddha was, you know, primarily an activist. That is what an ethicist is, actually, is that they are an activist, because they're concerned with the translation of integrity and ethics into the way we live. And, of course, part of that translation is the response to pain and the response of compassion. I don't think when we talk about responding to the difficult with compassion, I don't think we need to go into the very, very grand terms, but I think you just need to invite into your attention the person in your life right now who you feel some ill will towards or some aversion towards. I don't think we need to go very far, and we don't need to think always about the, you know, saving the world, but what is it like right now to invite into the field of your attention someone that you avoid, someone that you push away, someone that you judge? What is it like to actually hold that person in this capacity of the mind, both for empathy and responsiveness? It's not. That makes sense to you? Huh?
It's
really difficult. And part of the difficulty, because, I mean, it's really good to look at the difficulty and the reluctance to do so. The reluctance to do so. Sometimes the fear of repeated injury, which is totally understandable, you know? And wise action doesn't mean inviting that person into our house, you know, and say, beat me again. But it might mean, can we embrace that with compassion for ourselves and another mutually? Because I don't think they happen independently. You know, I mean, if I can explain this. You have someone in your life who's harmed you in some way. There is whatever ignorance it might be that motivates that harm, and there's also the imprint of that harm on ourselves. And I think the healing is mutual. It's not like I then bring empathy and karuna to that person and leave myself out of the equation. It's also an appreciation and an empathy for that suffering, and an asking, what does this need? But it's also recognizing that the people and the events in our life that we most push away and disbar from compassion, these are the people and the events that we're most imprisoned by. You know, that we think about the most, that we fear the most, that we dwell upon the most. And so it's where the need for healing is almost the most urgent. But it's simultaneous. It is not me first, then you. is, or not you first and then me. You know, the cooperativeness of the suffering is so interwoven. You know, the suffering is so interwoven. It is almost like it needs to be a mutual empathy and responsiveness. What the suffering internally needs might be different than what the person who has harmed us needs. And that's the scale we're playing inwardly. But the truth is that we are most imprisoned by those events and people we most shut out. They come to define our life from there on in, about who we avoid or who we fear coming close to. It is difficult, but it's almost more difficult not to. And I think compassion is hard practice, you know, I really do. I mean, and I think this is a kind of challenge of the Brahma Viharas, because they look so lovely when you first look at them, you know. You know, they just look so uplifting and, you know, boundless friendliness and boundless compassion. I mean, it just sounds so great. But then when you actually come down to what it means and the kind of transformation it asks for, then I think we appreciate the sort of the courage and the insight and the transformation that's involved in actually developing. And as I say, we start with boundaries, you know? And it's almost like there's a skillfulness to this practice, you know? And I see this often when I'm teaching people, like, you have to know how close to come to the fire and when to step away from it. You know, and when it comes to the most difficult person in my life, you know, I may not be inviting them into my heart. You know, that door is too wide open, you know. But I might invite them to sit in the cushion beside me and think, well, how close can I come? You know, how close can I come? I might put them on my walking path beside me and take them up and down and think, well, how close can I come to this, you know? And there will be a lot of factors that influence that at different times. But I will be making that inclusiveness in some way. I will have that dedication of knowing how close to come to the fire, when to step away from it. But knowing that if I step too close to it too quickly, I get burnt. If I step away from it too far, you know, it just keeps burning there in the background. No, that's getting into explanation, I think. You know, and I think, you know, ignorance is not that personal. You know, and I think sometimes that's the way that we're trying to explain the unskillful to ourselves. You know, oh, you know, they're a spiritually uneducated person, or, you know, they've had a terrible childhood or whatever. It doesn't matter. The unskillful happened. You know, and we can't always see the threads underneath it. And the explanation doesn't really help us. What we are actually faced is, this is suffering. This is suffering. This is dukkha. How is it healed? How is it healed? Or how is it brought to an end? And how do we not keep throwing the logs on the fire, and how do we not incorporate that dukkha into our personal identity about who we are and how we live? How do we undo those chains? You know, and sometimes we will never understand what causes the unskillful action of another, and I think that's part of putting down the argument, is putting down that demand to understand before we allow them to sit on the cushion beside us. And it doesn't mean inviting them into our house. It doesn't mean inviting another blow on the head. You know, there's a lot of wise action of avoidance that can be very skillful in our life. But not to actually hold that, be fostering that fear and ill will in our own minds. It is difficult. I would never underestimate it. When we speak about compassion in certainly in the framework of inner development, it's a very multi-spectrum term. I mean, even the words, you know, anukampa and karuna are really not sufficient. Because when actually we speak about compassion and in the Buddhist teaching, we're actually getting into the entire territory of the paramis, or the inner perfections of patience, generosity, forgiveness, forbearance, energy, dedication. We're getting into that whole territory. This is such a multi-spectrum development. And I think it's very important to appreciate that. But I think this path without this emphasis upon compassion becomes actually a little bit devoid of meaning and a little bit shrunken in its area of concern. But it is the hardest part. It is. I'll be with you in a moment. It's the most difficult. It's the most difficult. That's not the right word to use it. It is one of the most liberating aspects of the practice. It is one of the most liberating aspects of the practice, because I think to live a life with that unshakable compassion is truly discovering what it means to be unimprisoned, to be ungoverned, and to be undefined by pain. And I think it is that place where actually the argument with the unarguables has truly actually been put down. But that is a training. You know, it's a moment-to-moment training, and it's a training of some immediacy, and it's a training of the moment, you know. And it's like those small moments where we put down with the argument really do make a difference and really do matter. Yeah? And again, it's like there's a saying from the Tibetan tradition. It says, do not think that these small moments of resentment and aversion and ill will don't matter, that it only takes a spark to set a mountain alight. And it also says, you know, it goes on to say, do not think that all those small moments of generosity and forgiveness and intimacy don't matter, because the great oceans are filled drop by drop. You know, so this is coming back to this whole question of inclining. Where does the mind incline? Where do we commit to making our home? And it's like life is the classroom of this. This is not something abstract. It's like life is truly the classroom of this. This is where we learn, and this is where these qualities are cultivated. Yes, please.
I mentioned the 10 paramitas. I have three ones that should be part of the 10, but I don't know if they are. One is courage, another one is humility. Are they part of the 10?
Humility is not mentioned very specifically in Buddhist psychology, although I think the whole of the path is humbling. You know, as a friend of mine said, you know, every time I sit, it's like receiving one moment of insult after another. You know, so, you know, humility is certainly built into anybody who sits on the cushion and looks on their own mind. Courage is part. The word in Pali is virya, and it's usually translated as energy, but its more accurate translation is heroism or courage.
It's like Mahavira, the wandering naked ascetic who founded Jainism. He was like more, I believe he was a contemporary of Lord Buddha.
Well, that's a different discussion, but I think you don't actually have to look at very big romantic figures to find virya and heroism and courage. You know, I personally discover that every retreat I teach. that I am awed by people's courage and willingness actually to show up for themselves moment after moment and hour after hour, you know, and actually commit themselves to wakefulness rather than to forgetfulness. So I don't think we actually have to look very far outside of ourselves to actually discover that quality of courage and heroism. Yeah. Yes, please. Okay, can we do this very briefly? Okay.
It's about three or four people that become friends with and three with someone that killed their child.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's incredible.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Yes, please.
So it's as difficult as it is to have metta for someone like a parent who's injured you or whatever, at least there's a relationship there. And can you talk a little bit about skillful responses to things like terrorism or climate change, like things that are more abstract?
Okay. So the question was about, you know, it's difficult enough to have sort of a sense of holding someone with metta who's, you know, you have a personal relationship with, you know, where there's been some kind of injury. And then we get, of course, into the much bigger domains of harm, you know, terrorist acts or, you know, acts of ferocity and cruelty that are beyond. And again, you know, it's not as if we can avoid this. This is part now of all of our lives. You know, we're introduced to ways of human beings relating to one another in more vivid ways than we... I mean, they've probably always been there through human history, you know? But because of technology, we cannot shut ourselves down to it. Our awareness has increased with technology. It's very easy, as in all things, to generalize and to abstract. You know, it's also very easy to turn away from, you know, to turn it all off, to, you know, just get on with my life. You know, it's hard enough without including this vast domain of suffering. This is what compassion asks us to do, not to generalize. These are human beings caught in the midst of the most terrible circumstances. We see it in, sometimes in bite-sized pieces in our own world. We don't have to look far, actually, to walk down the streets of downtown Victoria. You know, we have big ones of hatred and ill will. This is the extension that is demanding. This is the extension that's truly difficult. To actually see the humanity where there appears to be no humanity, both of the victim and of the perpetrator. This is why this is a hard path. You know, this is why people fall by the wayside. This is why it's hard to continue. But this is what dukkha is. This is what suffering is. And this is what this path has actually asked us to meet. Anywho, I think we're coming to the end of this day. I want to end with, at least my bit, with a story. Some of you might know it. I stand by the bed where a young woman lies, her face post-operative, her mouth twisted in a palsy, clownish, a tiny twig of the facial nerve, the one to the muscles of her mouth, has been severed. She will be thus from now on. As surgeon, I had followed with religious fervor the curve of her flesh. I promise you that. Nevertheless, to remove the tumor in her cheek, I had to cut the little nerve. Her young husband is in the room. He stands on the opposite side of the bed, and together they seem to dwell in the evening lamplight, isolated from any private. The woman speaks. Will my mouth always be like this, she says. Yes, I say. It's because the nerve was cut. She nods, is silent, but the young man smiles. I like it, he says. It's kind of cute. Unmindful of my presence, he bends to kiss her crooked mouth, and I'm so close I can see how he twists his own lips to accommodate hers, to show her that their kiss still works. And then another story. I will ad lib to sit alongside of this. After the ending of apartheid, when the Truth and Reconciliation Committee was meeting in South Africa, and torturers would come face to face with those they had tortured, and mothers would come face to face with those who had killed their children. And Archbishop Tutu, in leading these meetings, said when these people could look each other in the eye, when they could sit in the room, same room together, and look each other in the eye and speak of their stories, he said, as if something sacred had entered that room, and all that we could do would be still. This is a kind of spectrum. So can I ask that we just take 10 minutes to sit together to end our day?